the opportunity to present this talk. Well, that's the title. I am going to start by basically some motivation. And I think for me to be able to see the screen, I'm going to be standing around here somewhere. Do you see? Oh, yeah, there we go. All right, so. Some motivation for phase space gate symmetry. It is an unfamiliar concept, although I must say I was surprised that in the past couple of weeks or 3 weeks, I've been meeting people here, Moffat. And Lee and Friedel that have shown, have had their own interest in phase-based gauge symmetries, actually in phase-based methods, maybe not gauge symmetries. So it seems as if PI is a hot place for phase-based gauge symmetries suddenly. Now, I've been doing this for about 15 years or so. And what motivated it for me back in 1995 is that I noticed that M theory provides some hints for two times. And so if you want, which I'm going to explain in a minute, so if you want to take this seriously, so namely, is there really two times somewhere, then it was evident that I must find a gauge symmetry to ensure causality, unitarity, and absence of ghosts in a two-time formulation for all physics. Because if this would apply to M theory, it's supposed to apply for all physics. So you need to find a gauge symmetry to ensure that there are no problems in the formulation itself. So this began a search 15 years ago. And by now, I can state that this is indeed a general principle of all physics, a phase-space gauge symmetry that I'm going to discuss. Just basically outlined because I cannot really condense the stuff that happened in 15 years. Basically, what I'm going to discuss is what happened in the first year or two, because that would be enough to actually explain what the ideas are. And then if people are interested, I'm willing to give more detailed seminars about aspects that I will not be able to discuss here today. So I just want to say that it works for all classical and quantum mechanics. It works for field theory, including the standard model, including general relativity, all the way to supergravity. All that I have achieved so far. So far, string theory is still underdeveloped in this framework, although I do have some developments in that line as well. What do you gain from doing it is that this is a principle that makes a vast number of predictions that you can verify either by theoretical methods or experimental methods if you prefer. And those predictions are systematically missed in the one-time formulation of physics at all scales of distance and of energy. And I will give examples of what that is, and that there is in fact a vast number of information not captured by the usual one-time formulation of physics. So I will demonstrate that. First of all, about the hints of two times in M theory, it starts with the supersymmetry of M theory, the extended supersymmetry. Now, usual supersymmetry that is the most familiar version is that you have supercharges, Q with Q, that gives you momentum on the right-hand side. Now, however, this can be extended in various dimensions. It can be extended with additional central charges. And in M theory, the full extension of the superalgebra with 32 supercharges is momentum in 11 dimensions, a two-brain in 11 dimensions, and a five-brain in 11 dimensions. That's the full content of the extension. So now what I noticed in 95, and that was soon after the string revolution in 1995, is that the 32 spinner in 11 dimensions is, of course, a wild spinner in 12 dimensions, like it is for every even dimension and then one lower up dimension. So it's always the case that the wild spinner of an even dimension is the normal spinner, the Dirac spinner, in one less dimension, in an odd number of dimensions. So it's the case also that the 11-dimensional spinner, which has 32 components, is also the wild spinner in 12 dimensions, which also has 32 components. However, these must be real. In M theory, they must be real. But if the signature, of 12 dimensions is other than 10, 2, two times, if it is different than that, then the spinner is complex. But if the signature is 10, 2 with two times, then the spinner is real. So therefore, the left side of this equation can be considered as a super anti-commutator in 12 dimensions. If that's the case, then the right-hand side should be possible to reorganize in 12 dimensions as well, because all you are doing is multiplying two spinners in 12 dimensions and looking for what is available, what appears group theoretically on the right-hand side. And what does appear in 12 dimensions is a two brain in 12 dimensions and a sixth brain, a set tool sixth brain in 12 dimensions, such that P with Z2 over here is just the T2 over there. And then the Z5 is the self-dual T6 on the right-hand side. So indeed, the superalgebra of M theory is a 12-dimensional superalgebra, which says that M theory, whatever depends in M theory just on the superalgebra, and there's a huge amount of things that you can do only with the superalgebra, all of that has automatically an interpretation in 10 plus 2 dimensions. So all of those aspects of M theory, you have them already in M theory as being 12 dimensional properties. Now the question is whether this is there more to this story? Is it just an accident? Of course, we don't know the full extent of M theory. We don't know what it is all about, really, fully. So we don't know what is the completion of the theory of M theory, which is consistent with 12 dimensions at this point. All right, so now soon after this observation, other clues for two times developed, as you know, in F-theory, and something that I called S-theory, which started from this and went to 13 dimensions. So, and all that was either geometrical aspects or algebraic aspects, which did not really take seriously the two times. It was just a tool, if you like, some mathematical tool, to extract properties that are related to either 12 dimensions in F theory or 13 dimensions in S theory. Now, what if you take it seriously? Does it mean that there is perhaps a hidden extra time dimension? So if you take it seriously, then you have to face a real huge problem. And that problem is the problem of ghosts and problems of causality. So therefore, you really have to find a way for how you can make a theory with two times actually a reasonable theory. All right, so now first thing that comes to mind is perhaps Kubitzer-Klein. In the same way that when you add extra space dimensions, you can basically get rid of them in low energies by using the Kubitzer-Klein idea, could you do the same thing for extra time-like dimensions? And so this is the wrong idea for extra time dimensions. It doesn't work, and so very quickly you can see why. So there will be, for example, vectors in the extra dimensions, in 12 dimensions, including extra time, that depend, that have extra components as well as extra dependence on space-time. So if you look at the kinetic terms that you would write, for example, in a field theory for a vector, then there will be wrong sign kinetic terms for the time-like dimensions. Even for the first time-like dimension, you are going to have wrong sign kinetic terms. This means ghosts. So for one time, we know how to remove the ghosts. Basically, it's gauge symmetry. For extra times, you mean in order to remove those ghosts, in order to remove those extra degrees of freedom, you need even stronger gauge symmetries, but they are not available as usual gauge symmetries. So you need enough gauge symmetry to remove ghosts from vectors, tensors, spinners, and so on. But also you need to remove the extra time dimensions from the space-time dependence Otherwise, we will have causality problems. Okay, so because you can have cross time like curves much more easily if you have an extra time dimension. So namely, what you need is really remove everything that is extra down to ordinary spacetime. This is really what you need. You need enough gauge symmetry to be able to do that. If you don't, Kaluza-Klein excitations in the extra time-like dimensions will always be ghosts. All of them will be an infinite tower, of course. So you really need to come down to the little x, and you really need to come down from big M to the mu. So what remains if you do that? If you imagine having such a gauge symmetry, what will remain? Is it just the ordinary one-time physics? And the answer turns out that no. You need to identify what is the little x as a function, as how it is embedded in the extra space-time, and you will find that there are many, many kinds of one-time spaces that you can embed in the extra dimensions when you have extra times. So I will call those shadows, and shadows is the only thing that is possible that can remain if you try to imagine the gauge symmetry. So how do we, yeah.
Extra time, is it periodic or not?
It could turn out it will be infinite dimensional, just like any other time. And you will see how. All right, so two-time physics developed by finding the fundamental solution to these problems, to the ghost and the causality problems, and the answer came in 98 as a gauge symmetry in phase space. So that was the beginning for me for how a gauge symmetry in phase space can solve those problems. I started with examples, and by now it became a general principle. So now, once you have gauge symmetries, as in all gauge symmetries, you also have automatically a principle for writing down dynamics, consistent dynamics. And so this will be one of the things, one of the consequences of the gauge symmetry will be, in fact, that you must have the extra time. And I will demonstrate how you must have the extra time. All right, so then let me discuss what it is. So as a general principle, we learned from Einstein that general coordinate invariance removes the bias of observers in position states. So to be able to write down fundamental equations of physics, you need to remove the effect of the observer in position space, as we learned from Einstein. Now, the next level for that, in this context, is that you need to remove the bias in phase space, not only in position space. And so the question is how we can do that. So we have hints for where we have phase space symmetries. We have phase space symmetries in Poisson brackets in the form of canonical transformations. We have also in the quantum commutators, we have canonical transformations as symmetries. And there are also these dualities in M theory, which are also transformations in phase space. For example, electric magnetic charges are transformations in phase space. They are discrete, but they are transformations in phase space. And so it's ideas like that gave me a hint for how to proceed. So basically, the proposal is that canonical transformations, I want to turn them into a gauge symmetry. Ordinary canonical transformations will be regarded as being global symmetry, because ordinary canonical transformations do not remove degrees of freedom. So you need to turn them into local symmetries in order to be able to remove degrees of freedom. And so to do that, I will start with the word line, just a single particle on the word line. And after understanding that, we go on to field theory, but not today. And then to embellish it with symmetries, with spin, with supersymmetry, with other things that are needed in order to describe, for example, the standard model or gravity or supergravity. So all of that has been achieved. But it's not so far a completed project. Ultimately, I expect that the final version of this is going to be field theory in phase space. And again, I don't have the time to discuss that today. So from all of that, it will turn out that two-time is not an input. It is a consequence of the gauge symmetry. Just like gauge symmetries have certain consequences, for example, forces, electromagnetic forces, weak forces, QCD forces, they emerge by demanding a certain structure of a gauge symmetry. here by demanding a certain stature of a gauge symmetry, two times is going to be an output of the gauge symmetry. So now this topic has developed, as I mentioned already, in classical and quantum phase space to start with. It went on to local field theory. The final phase of that I expected to be phase space field theory. In all of these areas, I have done a whole bunch of things. For today, it will be just the very beginning. Okay, that's all I have as far as time is concerned. I will just basically discuss a little bit. Yeah.
Field theory, you mean fields are defined for every position and
for,
momentum?
For phase space, yes. Yeah. Functions of x and p that you need to multiply in specific ways. Turns out it's a Moyen star. That's the only way you can multiply them for it to make sense. And then we take gauge symmetry in order to make it compatible with field theories that you know. But the program is not finished. There is work, but it's not finished. So now it will turn out as a gauge symmetry, the thing that is going to work is symplectic transformations, SP2R, as a gauge symmetry in phase space. I will show you in what form. And appropriate extensions of SP2R with spin and supersymmetry. Again, for today, it will be without spin, without supersymmetry, because I just want to describe the basic ideas. All right, so first I want to start with global canonical transformations, seen as a global symmetry. So if you define transformations of X and transformations of P through the Poisson bracket of X with a function epsilon. Epsilon is a function of both x and p, so Poisson brackets, so which gives you that quantity, the derivative of epsilon. And then similarly for p, it gives you the derivative of epsilon with respect to x. So under such canonical transformations, the Poisson brackets themselves are invariant. Quantum commutators are invariant, provided you also take care of ordering of quantum factors. And also, this first term in any Lagrangian, this first term in any Lagrangian transforms like a total derivative with respect to tau, with respect to time, with respect to proper time. So therefore, its integral, which is the action is invariant. So for this first term. So we have a huge amount of symmetry in the first term of any Lagrangian, as well as in the definition of various, say, classical mechanics or quantum mechanics. So it's a good place to start, but as you know, canonical transformations cannot remove degrees of freedom. It only reorganizes your degrees of freedom, but it cannot remove degrees of freedom. So what I'm looking for is a gauge symmetry that will be able to remove degrees of freedom. But before I go on, let me just say that such transformations with an epsilon of this type, they contain all the gauge transformations that you are familiar with. Maxwell transformation, the gauge symmetries in Maxwell's equations, in Einstein's equations, in Young-Mills equations, and much more than that. And just to give you a little bit of that, imagine trying to compute the rest of this with some Hamiltonian, a general function, a Hamiltonian, which is a general function of X and P as an example, a metric coupled to covariant momentum in this way, where G is a background field, A is a background field. So in other words, this is a function, Hamiltonian function of x and p only, but its dependence on x can come through background fields. So if you apply the transformation law on this Lagrangian, the first term I already mentioned is invariant. The second term, this transformation is going to generate transformations on A, wherever it appears, and on G, such that the transformation on A will be Maxwell's type gauge transformation where the parameter is this lambda, the first function of x in epsilon. And G is going to transform, as well as A and so on, all vectors are going to transform with general covariance transformations where the transformation parameter is this epsilon of m. So this type of general canonical transformation has a lot of the type of gauge symmetries that you are familiar with in position space. And now we are trying to go beyond by including them, but also trying to go beyond. So this can be generalized with spin and supersymmetry, but not today. And for non-abelian Young-Mills type of transformations, one can use fiber bundles. Again, I don't have time for that today. So now the proposal to turn it into a local symmetry is the following, is to replace epsilon, which is already a function of tau through x and through p, with additional tau dependence. Additional tau dependence, which namely tau dependence, which does not come through x and p alone. If I do that, then this is what I will mean by having a gauge symmetry on the word line. So this gauge symmetry on the word line is going to transform x and p into each other at every instant during any motion. So position and momentum become indistinguishable. They can be renamed, and you can choose gauges or whatever at any instant during any motion. So this is what you will be able to do if you can manage to promote this thing into a covariant derivative rather than ordinary derivative. All right, so this is what I want. And so the way I managed to do it is the following. Just like the epsilon was a function of x and p only, take many of them, many epsilons, call them qa. And then multiply every q with a parameter, epsilon a of tau, and sum it up. So what I'm going to require for the things to work out is that the q's are generators of canonical transformations such that they close. They form some Lie algebra. It doesn't have to be a simple Lie algebra, as long as it is some Lie algebra, as long as they close, is what is going to be required to begin with. So in other words, first you need to start with a construction of a set of q's that close. All right, so let's assume we have done that. Then a Lagrangian, which is going to be gauge invariant, is going to be the ordinary term plus gauge fields coupled to these. In other words, for every epsilon, there is a corresponding gauge field. And then a Hamiltonian such that the Hamiltonian commutes with every q, okay? Q and under Poisson brackets. So under that, then the transformation of x is what I mentioned before, but with the epsilon on the outside. Then it's a Poisson bracket at fixed tau, if you like, which gives you this transformation as a function of tau for x and for p, similarly. And then also you need to transform A, the gauge field, in the same way that you would transform any gauge field, non-abelian gauge field. So namely, it contains a derivative of the epsilon and then a non-abelian term. So if you do that, then this Lagrangian will transform into a total derivative. All right, so now we have the method. Okay, so that's the method. At this point, I mentioned everything as if it is the canonical variables of a single particle, but need not be. So X, big X, can be a collection of positions of many particles, if you want to. So is the P. And so this can be a theory, not necessarily for a single particle, but it can be a theory for many particles. And we are imposing, and then we have generators of transformations. As long as they close, they are going to give you a gauge symmetry. Right. Oh. It can be zero. In fact, in most cases, it will be zero, but not only zero. I will give you an example. Not only zero. It's not all canonical transformations. It's the set of canonical transformations that I'm going to include in the definition of my theorem. Yes. Yeah. Right. All right. So now let's begin to try to find out what is the content of this theory. First thing is that equation of motion with respect to the gauge field is going to require that q, every q must vanish. Now, this makes sense because q is a generator of gauge transformations. When every q vanishes, it means you must be in the gauge invariant sector of phase space. So therefore, you will be able to describe the gauge invariant part of the physics, provided you find the solution to these equations where x and p satisfy that the q's are vanishing. So later you will see that solutions to these is what I will call the shadows of the higher dimensional space or phase space. Now, again, to guide you at least for string theories, you can think of this set of generators as the analog of the Virasoro constraints. So the Virasoro constraints would satisfy some closure property, and they would have to vanish. so to define the physical states. So if it helps, you can try to think that these are, in some sense, it has some similarity to Virasoro constraints. Now, to give you a very familiar example, take the case of a single Q, okay, just one. Okay, just one. Of course, it closes. And one particular example of Q is P squared over 2, just P squared. So as you know, this describes the massless relativistic particle with the constraint that P squared vanishes. So that's the massless relativistic particle. So it's an example of this with a single Q. So more generally, that Q, you can replace it with any general function of X and P. So this will be a one-parameter non-compact abelian gauge symmetry when you have a single P. And then you can see that for this to work, so namely for in trying to find the gauge invariant set for this particular case, I have to say P squared is 0. So that's the gauge invariant set. But P squared equal to 0 cannot be solved unless you have one time. If it is Euclidean, the solution is trivial. So you have to allow that there must be one time in order to have non-trivial content. So therefore, I will reverse my reasoning here, and I will say the requirement of a gauge symmetry of that type requires that you must have one time. Okay, so the introduction of time would follow from the introduction of the gauge symmetry. So this type of reasoning is going to get generalized when I have more constraints, and we will see that this is how the extra time is going to get introduced. No, at this time, I just said that in order to have a solution, in order to have a solution to P squared equal to 0, you must have one time. You can have. Very good. So why don't you allow two times? Is because then there will be ghosts. You are going to have, so in order for it to be unitary, you cannot allow more than one. All right. So exactly, it's a good point. All right. So now,
but this is perfectly fine, as you know.
So
the Hamiltonian is going to emerge once you choose a gauge. So for example, x0 is tau. So therefore, that is the time. X0 gets identified as time. Tau is your evolution parameter. So x0 becomes the evolution parameter if you choose that gauge. Then its canonical conjugate, which is p0, becomes the Hamiltonian. That's the canonical conjugate to x0. That is the Hamiltonian. So you solve from p squared equal to 0, you solve for p0. And as you know, that is the Hamiltonian. So more generally, you can do that for any function of x and p. And from that notion, you will solve, by choosing a gauge, for what you call time, you are going to solve this canonical conjugate will be always the Hamiltonian. All right, so now let me go beyond one generator. So I will take three generators. I will call them Q11, Q22, and Q12. The associated closure is going to be three generators. What do we have? That closes is SP2. If they are real, so that's why it's SP2R, under Poisson brackets. So you require that they close under Poisson brackets. And so you write down, again, this form. So you have the gauge fields and the Qs, three of them and three of them. So now, as an example of that, I need to construct them, okay? If you don't construct them in such a way that they close, you haven't started. All right, so you need to construct them. So here is an example. Q11 is x dotted into x, p dotted into p, x dotted into p. Take Poisson brackets between these guys. One x will always eat one p under Poisson brackets. So therefore, they will always close. All right, so this is SP2. It's one particular construction. But I have an infinite number of constructions of this type that involve background fields, gravitational fields, electromagnetic fields, all sorts of high spin fields, and so on, whatever you like, basically. So there are an infinite number of constructions of this type. So this is the simplest of those. So here is an example. So therefore, this is supposed to work now. But now we have to look at the content. So the gauge invariant sector is the sector in which all the queues vanish. So these guys have to vanish. So now this says that you have two light-like vectors, x squared 0, p squared 0, two light-like vectors that must be orthogonal to one another, except p equal to 0. So they are orthogonal. So therefore, if you have 0 times, of course, it's trivial. If you have 1 time, the only solution is that they must be parallel. If they are parallel, angular momentum is 0, and that is trivial too. Even a free particle has angular momentum relative to some center. So therefore, in order to have non-trivial content, you must have 2 times. Now, 2 times begins to worry you. However, I have a gauge symmetry. And the gauge symmetry is just right to remove the Gauss and the causality problems. All right, so therefore, this is a good theory. It's a reasonable good theory from that point of view. And actually, you will see it really has a lot of surprises, and some of them I will mention. So now, so this, by the way, this general argument will work always for 2 times. The reason is that the signature of the parameters of SP2 are such that they will always remove 2 times and 1 space. So you have 3 of them. They will always remove 2 times and 1 space. So the 2 times you must remove in order not to have ghosts. The 1 space is coming along as extra. Okay, so an additional space is also needed in order to come down to the usual space, like 3-dimensional. If you want to live in 3-dimensional space, you must start with a 6-dimensional space with signature 4, 2. Yeah.
Once for 2 times, what about light poles? Because the x squared equal to 0.
Yeah.
Normal 1 time.
X squared and p squared must be 0, and they must be orthogonal. That's the condition for this theory. So I must have 2 times.
And a light pole.
Yeah, in phase space, both for X and for P. Yeah. All right, so now let me take the example of the flat case. So by flat, I mean that the dot product over here is with a D comma 2, okay? So with D comma 2 space, with the metric of S of D comma 2. So in that case, you can see that that this theory must have an S of D comma 2 symmetry, because everywhere I have only dot products. And therefore, it must, this theory has a global symmetry of rotations under SOD comma 2. So, namely, every Q commutes with every element. So, this says that the Qs are SOD comma 2 invariant, but they also say that the element are gauge invariant. Okay, because the Qs are generators of gauge transformations. So, therefore, the Ls are gauge invariant. So, in fact, it turns out all gauge invariants in this theory, in phase space, in the phase space of this theory, are general functions of element. So, in particular, I can choose my Hamiltonian, extra Hamiltonian if I wanted to be whatever function I want of these elements. So, this would be a gauge invariant thing. If I pick particular directions of element, I will break the SOD cover symmetry. But still, I will not break the gauge symmetry. So it still will be gauge invariant, even though I could break the SOD command. All right. So this allows you to make all sorts of models, but I will not explore it very much today. So I will, in fact, take it as 0. All right. So let me continue. So now, what is the content? How to recognize ordinary physics? Okay, so to recognize ordinary physics, I really need to choose gauges, come down to a one-time ordinary kind of space where we are accustomed to understand physics. All right, so to do that, I need to choose gauges and solve these constraints. So to do that, I will choose my metric, the SOD comma 2 metric. I will choose it with Lyapunov type variables, and then mu is the familiar type of D dimensions, one space and one time. So over here there is one space and one time, and over here there is, one time and many D minus one space dimensions, and here one space and one time. So X plus minus is the extra time and the extra space, basically.
All right, so now under these transformations, so what are the canonical transformations that are generated by these guys and all the X's and P's? It turns out that it's the transformation of X and P is like doublets, okay, under this SP2 transformation. X and P form like the two components of a doublet in every direction, in the plus prime, in the minus prime, and in the new direction. You just have doublets under these transformations. So you have three parameters. Like SL2R, SP2R transformations, and every doublet. So this is the gauge transformation generated by these guys. So therefore, in choosing gauges, what I will do first is make two gauge choices and then solve two of the constraints and leave behind one gauge choice not made and one constraint not solved. Okay, so this is what I will do. So to do that, let me start from this X plus prime, P plus prime doublet. And then I can make two gauge choices by making this entry 0 and that entry 1. So this is for all tau, okay? So these guys, for all tau, have been fixed to 0 and 1. Next, I want to solve the X squared equal to 0 constraint. So with this metric, X squared is formed by taking this quantity, X plus, multiply with X minus, with a minus 2 in front, and then plus X mu squared. And you can see that when X minus is this, it solves the constraint. Okay, so this multiplied by that with a minus 2, and then plus X squared. So that solves the X squared constraint. And then I will solve the X dot P constraint, which says you multiply this guy with a minus sign, and this guy with a minus sign. So X dot P minus X dot P, and then add X dot P. So that solves the big X dot P to P constraint. And then what remains is the P squared constraint, big P squared, but big P squared is multiplying this guy with this guy, which is 0, plus little P squared. So big P squared is equal to little P squared. So it says that in the remaining phase space, for which I have not yet chosen a gauge, little P squared must be 0. So therefore, the content here, the remaining content, degrees of freedom is X mu of tau, P mu of tau, with P squared equal to 0. And that's, of course, the massless relativistic particle. And notice, in doing so, I have chosen what I mean by time. By time, I mean either the x0 or whatever you want in here. The others have been fixed. So time has been embedded, this for time that leads to this interpretation, has been embedded in D plus two dimensions in the way that you see it right now. All right, so now I want to show you that there are many other solutions to this. So this is one shadow. So I came down two dimensions, and this is one shadow. There are no Kaluza-Klein type of degrees of freedom. So now another solution, I will not take the time to tell you, but instead of 0 there, choose it something proportional to a mass. And then let me just say at the end it solves the constraints, with the remaining constraint being little p squared plus little m squared, which is the mass parameter, equal to 0. So massive particle. Another gate choice is I call this just a mass parameter for all tau. I call the p0 over here equal to 0 for all tau, and then solve the constraints. And what remains, the remaining constraint, is that the H, which is canonical conjugate to P over there, H must equal to P vector squared. P vector squared is the remaining vector component, so over 2m. So that's the non-relativistic particle, another shed. You can see here that mass is emerging as a modulus in the embedding of two-dimensional phase space into D plus 2 in different ways. Now, you can continue with more gauge choices. And I will just tell you that what another one is all maximally symmetric spaces. That is, P and X must satisfy a condition with a metric, which corresponds to what you would write down as P mu, P nu, G mu nu of X, where that G mu nu of X is a maximally symmetric space. in each case, I had three, right? Three constraints, three gauge conditions and three constraints. Solved two, I'm using only two of the constraints and two of the gauge parameters. So that means I'm removing two axes and two peaks. Yeah.
Two of them are, which ones are gauge?
So the, gauge my main here is TLH, before I choose the final constraints, okay? TLH and R vector and TLH. The same number as you would have.
No, the gauge conditions are which ones?
M. That this entry has been set equal to a constant.
Yeah.
And that this entry has been in momentum has been set to zero.
Okay.
Those are my two gauge conditions.
Okay.
And that's all two constraints. And then what remains is the same number of degrees of freedom as in the relativistic parabola. So here I'm showing to you that curvature also emerges as a modulus. And you can continue like that. You're going to find actually an infinite number of shadows like that with different physics interpretation, different one-time physics interpretation. So what is going on is that
time and Hamiltonian are different in each case. From the point of view of one time, they are different. And these are really one-time perspectives in two-time phase space. They are just different perspectives looking at something in a higher dimensional space. So all of these guys can be gauge transformed to each other. They were obtained by making gauge choices. So therefore, you can transform from one case to the other. But among them, so X and P and so on and time and H, they are not gauging the eigen, obviously. But there are other things that are gauging the eigen. So as I showed you before, all of these quantities are gauging the eigen. So these quantities are not going to change from one gauge to the other. They are fixed. They are gauging the eigen. So therefore, there are predictions. There are an infinite number of predictions that certain things in one gauge are predicted to be certain things in another gauge. In particular, the Casimir operator of SOD, comma 2 is going to be the same one, right? Because it's a function of L. So therefore, the Casimir operator of SOD, comma 2, which is the hidden symmetry, SOD, comma 2 was a global symmetry. The global symmetry will not go away. It never goes away when you make gauge choices. It just becomes a hidden symmetry. So that hidden symmetry is present in all of these cases. In particular, for massless particles, it's conformal symmetry, right? SOD, comma 2 is conformal symmetry. For massive particles, you never knew that there was an SOD, comma 2, and there is one. That's the prediction. Non-relativistic particle, you never knew that there is an SOD, comma 2. That's the prediction. No, the mass is a parameter. It does not act on the mass. It only acts on X and P, on the remaining X and P. The physics are all the L's. Those are the things that are gauging there. Yeah? So what these are, they are dualities. If you make gauge transformations on the phase space of one and relate it to the other, these are dualities. So what is being predicted is an infinite set of dualities between certain familiar one-time systems. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I can. Yes, I can tell you. Although I wrote here X and P, it's not the same X and P as that. Okay, so this X and P is related to that X and P by a canonical transformation. That canonical transformation is just an SP2 transformation. It's just an SP2 transformation. So with that SP2 transformation, you relate this one to the other. That is the duality transformation. Under this duality, all these L's are gauging there. So in particular, the SOD, comma 2 is a gauge invariant prediction. So all of these systems are in the same SOD, comma 2 representation. And I will tell you which one. So,
is LMN in any of these theories? Like what would be the physical meaning of it?
Okay. So in this theory, they become the generators of conformal transformations. And conformal symmetry is a symmetry that you already used. You already knew from, you learned about it. It's a hidden symmetry that once you are taught what it is, you can verify.
And here, the other ones?
And here I'm telling you that they have hidden symmetries, just like that conformal.
So there's no physical meaning for this?
Oh, they are, of course, they are physical.
But if anything that you would know about it.
But you didn't know about it. That's the point. Okay, so I'm just telling you that it is there, you can verify, and you didn't know about it.
So now there is more interesting cases. I will go very quickly. A particle moving in the Robertson-Walker universe, closed, open, or zero, is another gate choice, is another one of these shadows. A particle moving in the background of a cosmological constant is another one of those shadows. A particle moving on a sphere, d minus 1 times time, is another one of those. And the Kepler problem, the hydrogen atom, is another one of those shadows. So all of these also are dual to one another. And they are all in the same SOD comma 2 representation, SO4 comma 2 if you want to relate to ordinary. Mm.
Sure that it reaches away against the momentum.
Of course. Okay.
Therefore, when you said there is an infinite number, well,
for all of check. Yeah, of course. For all of these cases, I have check. Okay. And for many of them, also at the quantum level. For many of them. Not all of them, but for many of them. Some of them, like a massive relativistic particle, because of the square roots, becomes a little hairy. But many others are not as hairy.
In other words, you can do any metric that is conformative aspects.
In fact, this is one of the results. I will summarize. You were asking what is the nature of LMN in some other cases. In the case of massive relativistic particle, so one subset is Lorentz transformation, which is a signature. Now, two others, which doesn't look like things that are familiar, but in the zero mass layer, look at this. In the zero mass layer, A becomes 1. So A becomes 1. So this becomes 1 half. This becomes 0. So that this term becomes just momentum, which is translations, right? So Lorentz transformations, translations in the massless limit. And then finally, this one in the massless limit becomes conformal transformation. In the presence of mass, they are some deformation, if you like, of the conformal transformations, but the deformation is all done because of the mass. All right, so this theory, x dot p minus a constraint, p squared plus m squared, is invariant under SOD comma 2.
They
are what?
They weren't valid globally.
So they were not valid globally, which means?
Well, for example, in the massless particle, you chose to set one of the x's to 1.
Yes, but that was a gauge.
Yes, right. Yeah. But you couldn't choose that gauge where that x was 0.
But I can choose the other one.
Right. But that's important. Right?
No, it's not important. The only thing which is important are the gauge invariants.
No, but what I mean is, So in any of the gauges that you pick, you're really picking, in a massless particle case, you're picking a copy of Minkowski space, R31, inside conforming convexified. And so you're missing the light frame of your mm-hmm. And the statement that there is a conformal invariance there is the statement, you know, the actual conformal transformations rather than just the Lorentz transformations are precisely the ones that produce all these light frames infinity rescaled. And the statement that the system's conformally invariant is that if you pick some other gauge, it looks exactly the same, the two smoothing map onto each other and so on.
Well, anyway, what you are trying to say, that there could be some subtleties in the gauge choices. I really don't. That's fine. The only thing which I want to emphasize is what is important are the gauge invariants. And so, if there are subtleties, you know, in other words, like if these solutions are not related, cannot be related to one another because the gate choice may be singular in some places, it remains to be studied. Okay, so let me leave it at that.
Okay,
it doesn't make it less interesting.
I'm not saying it's less interesting or interesting, but I'm just saying that, for example, the very difference between any of these Freeman, Robertson, Walker.
There are some major differences, and in particular among the gauges, whose let me tell you in what way. Okay, You see,
in this gauge, the way things come out is that every entry which depends on x, every entry depends on the little x. Okay, and there is no entry that depends among the x big x entries. There is none that depend on the momentum for this particular gauge. Not so in this case. Here I had x's, right, the big x's, but there is momentum dependence in there because A, you know, has momentum in it. So whenever this happens, whenever some of my x's end up depending on momentum, so those, I classify them as being the harder gauge choices. And then whenever it happens that the other x entries, they are all functions of the remaining x, I call them the easy ones. So I think the easy ones are the ones that you are, some of them you are more familiar with. And they are easier to deal with, in particular in local field theory, because there is a local field theory version of all of them. The others is the reason why I want to construct field theory in phase space, to better understand it. Because the others, in local field theory, they look non-local. Okay, so just a remark for now. Let me continue from here by giving you now a little bit of a summary of what I have said. So if I start from an SP2R gauge symmetry, it requires that I must have two times. A simplest example I gave you is this case, for which there is an SO4 comma 2 symmetry if I'm in 4 plus 2 dimensions. Now, this gives various shadows, the things I call shadows. I told you about the masses relativistic particle. This case, by the way, was discovered by Dirac back in the 1930s. In a very different formalism, without realizing that what one is dealing with is this phase-space gauge symmetry. He started from a very different place, but he also defined 6 dimensions and tried to describe massless particles, conformal symmetry in particular, from the point of view of 6 dimensions. So you can attribute that one to Dirac as a particular gauge choice. The others, you know, the massive, either relativistic or non-relativistic, they are brand new. Hydrogen atom is brand new. Harmonic oscillator, I didn't even mention, is another one. The Robertson-Walker, maximally symmetric spaces, including these guys, any conformally flat space, including some singular ones, and twisters, which you know, twisters, people know that they are related to massless particles, but it's well beyond that. I have shown that the same twister can be rewritten not only in terms of the phase space of the massless particle, but in terms of the phase space of all the other phases as well. So the same twister does that job as well. So all of these come out as shadows from what I, in the way that I have mentioned. And these shadows, there are really many more of them. I did not classify them. I only tried to find a few cases like these that are interesting to explain. But there will be similar infinite number of choices for more general choices of Q, more general choices of H, and also all of these have their analogs in two-time field theory. So this sort of stuff, which has the surprises and the dualities among the shadows, is much richer when you go also to field theory. So these are the types of predictions that you didn't have before in the formulation with one time only. So here you see emergent quantities in the form of spacetimes and parameters, mass couplings, curvature, and so on. The systems that emerge in one time, they are some of them free, some of them interacting. Time and Hamiltonian, they are attributed to different perspectives of the observer in phase space. How you embed your observer in this higher dimensional phase space. These are the perspectives that one needed to get rid of in the language I started to mention. By getting rid of that perspective, you rewrite all of those theories as a single equation, which is that. I mentioned that there are hidden symmetries in all of them. I computed the Casimir. The Casimir for all of them is the same pure number. 1 minus d squared over 4, which when d is 4 is just minus 3. This corresponds to the unitary representation called the singleton for SOD comma 2. So two-time physics is predicting all of these hidden symmetries and dualities among the shadows. And so the main points here is, first of all, there are no ghosts. That was the original motivation. How can I construct a theory that has extra time dimensions with no ghosts? So, and this is compatible with one-time physics. Which groups? Yeah, they are all fixed. They are all fixed to the cosineres of the symbol. They are all fixed. And then you are getting systematically new insight and new information which is absent in quantum physics. Yeah?
You say there are no ghosts. Are you talking about this particle theories, or are you talking about field theory?
Also in field theory. Field theory will start from here. And then I will have to write down field equations that are compatible with this gauge symmetry.
But what do you mean by ghost in the case of particle mechanics?
In the case of particle mechanics, you know, once you have X and P, out of any X and P, its canonical conjugate, you can make creation annihilation operators. So there is always some state that you can construct starting from a vacuum of those creation annihilation operators, and exciting.
So you're talking about field theory then?
Particles, X and P, and A and A dagger, of the X and P.
Quantum mechanics.
So if you have time-like dimensions that are degrees of freedom, time-like dimensions will always create negative noise gas. So therefore, you must get rid of every time direction in particle mechanics.
Am I supposed to think of all these things on the same physical system,
except
we just happen to choose different gauge?
They are, from the point of view of one time, they are different. Right? So if you try
So physically, are they same the system?
They are dual to one another. Okay. In the usual sense of dualities, just a richer set of dualities, they are dual to one another, that they preserve, that duality transformation preserves the SOD chemistry. All the generators of SOD, every single generator of SOD.
We just happen to choose different descriptions for
right. You choose different prescriptions of how you define time. Okay, so
it would be fantastic if these choices falls into different topological classes as David.
It could happen. Yeah. So I mean, the topology, I must say, I was familiar with, and then, you know, possibly there may be some more interesting discussion.
Are you really saying there's an SO4 comma 2, or are you saying it's SO4 cross SO2?
SO4 comma 2. For all of them. SO4 comma 2. Things, for example, for the hydrogen atom, the SO4 part is familiar to a bunch of people. Even the SO4 comma 2 has been known as being a dynamical symmetry of the hydrogen atom for a while. But dynamical symmetry is not a symmetry in the usual paradox of symmetries. Dynamical symmetry just means that the Hamiltonian can be embedded as a generator of some group or a function of generators. That's what people call dynamical symmetry. But what is the case that I showed is that the action of the hydrogen atom is invariant under SOD comma 2. Just like the action of massless particles is in there, and that is so different.
So, in general, in field theory, when you have a conformal variance, the energy momentum tends to solve its traces.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's not invariant. You can prove this.
Can we come to field theory? I will be happy to discuss that, just not to take the time right now. When we come, there is no time to discuss field theory today, but I'd be happy to discuss it. It's all consistent with this. Okay, let me now mention, at least for those
people interested in ADS-CFT, how the shadows might be used in ADS-CFT type correspondence. So now we have seen that shadows from flat 4 plus 2, they all have the same SO4 comma 2 symmetry. And they are all in the same representation of SO4 comma 2. So here is the flat case, of course, is 1, but then you have all of these that are in the same representation of SO4 comma 2. For many of them, it is a hidden symmetry, not really noticed. For example, for ADS4, the evident symmetry is SO3 commutator. That's the evident symmetry. That's the Killing symmetries of the metric of ADS4. But the conformal symmetry of the metric of ADS4 is SO4 commutator. So conformally coupled particles in ADS4, like if you're discussing field theory, they are symmetric on the SO4 commutator. And so that's the case also for these guys that are even smaller, that evidence symmetry is even smaller, that they all have the same SO4 commutator in the same representation. So, okay. So this is, some of it is possibly new information, and some of it is familiar to some people. When I discussed with people, some of it was familiar to others. Now, the usual case in ADS-CFT correspondence is to take a higher dimensional theory, which lives in ADS-5, and then relate it to the boundary of that one related to flat T+1 dimensions, and then use this connection to preserve the SO4 commutator symmetry in both of them, and in that way make this dictionary for how you take quantities in gravity and relate them to the conformal field theory. But since all of the others are in the same representation, you should be able to think that there are other boundaries of ADS-5, such that you can connect not only to the flat, but to all the other guys you should be able to connect. And so be able to use that kind of ADS-CFT correspondence in a richer way. Now, more than that, ADS-5 itself belongs to a series of shadows that comes from flat 5+2 dimensions, from SO5, 2. So in the same way that ADS-4 has hidden SO4, 2, ADS-5 has SO5, 2 hidden. And it comes from a flat theory in 5+2 dimensions, so it is only one of the members of shadows that come from there. So therefore, you can imagine applying the ADS-CFT type of ideas to any one of these, And even better, start at the top, ADS-CFT correspondence directly into time physics. And once established at that level, then you can take shadows from this side and shadows from that side and make lots of relations and predictions. So this has not been explored. A little bit, people tell me, some of this, some other boundaries of ADS-5, such as to R cross S3, has been explored. But only a little bit, and of course without realizing that it can be much more general.
Just choosing a different Q, not X square equal to 0, but X square equal to 1.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's what I did. A long time ago. I understand you guys are doing something like that.
But this is not 5+2, it's still 4+2 with a different gauge.
Yes. You can start from 4+2 and with one gauge choice you can come to lower dimension. And then relate to, I think you want to say. Now, time is passing. Unless you are willing to stay, which probably most people won't be willing to stay, I will skip. Okay, I will skip even a very brief description of how you go to field theory and how you do gravity. Let me only mention to do gravity, the Q11, Q12, Q22 that was in flat space gets replaced by X squared, gets replaced by a general function of X. The X, explicit X here, gets replaced by a vector.
And then the metric here gets replaced by a GMM of X. And then requiring closure, which is one of the first requirements, requiring closure, requires that W, V, and G must be related to one another in some specific ways. And only for those geometries, there is everything that I have mentioned. And that will include everything you know about gravity and shadows of that, dual shadows to everything in gravity. So
For example, massless particle
in the most general metric, because I am able to start from something which is considerably more general than just flat. All right, so that's the general idea. Again, I don't have time, but one shadow is the usual, that I just mentioned, the usual massless particle in an arbitrary metric. But there will be shadows related to this one. Now,
from all of this, I found what the rules are for writing down two-time field theory.
So, as I said before, the SOD parameter was not crucial. I could have broken that additional H. It's not, the crucial part is not the global symmetry, it is the local symmetry. And so the local symmetry is valid even in the independence of the general metric, but provided that general metric, big G and M, satisfies certain conditions for which there are infinite number of solutions. Okay, so
rules for field theory that is consistent with everything I said for particles have been found. Let me skip what they are, because I don't have the time to tell you what is different about two-time field theory as compared to ordinary field theory. Rules for gravity, which turns out to be unique, also have been found, and that's consistent with ordinary gravity, with all the usual interactions of gravity as a shadow, as one of the shadows. So let me just summarize quickly the progress so far. The part I told you is about this local SP2R as a general principle in classical and quantum mechanics. Let me mention, this is very difficult to generalize. SP2R required two times. You can say, well, generalize SP2R, will I get three times, will I get four times, and so on. It's very difficult to generalize because, remember, SP2R required two times, one time was not possible, right? So if you enlarge the group, you are going to have constraints that you need to solve. And you need to ask, are there solutions to those constraints? And then there will always be solutions with plenty of times. But then is there enough gauge symmetry to remove the ghosts is the question. And then it's very difficult. I have not found a generalization of that in the case of a single particle. If I'm dealing with the phase space of a single particle, I have not found a generalization. So it looks like rather special. And therefore, two-time physics also rather special. Now, if you deal with the phase space of many particles, then there are richer possibilities. And then that's been explored. At this point, it has been explored a little bit, but not fully. All right, so as a general principle for a single particle, this seems to be rather special. Now, jumping from there, consistent with that, how to do field theory, has been done. And in that context, the standard model, general relativity, Grad unified theories, and so on, they all have been constructed. And shadows of that agrees with everything we know in the standard model and so on, except in the Higgs sector. For the Higgs sector, there is a prediction that there must be an additional scalar to which the Higgs has to couple in order to preserve conformal symmetry. Because SO4,2 is a predicted symmetry at the classical level for the field theory. If you include a mass term for the Higgs, a bare mass term for the Higgs, you will break that. Except for that, the standard model is conformally invariant at the classical level. Now, in order to generate the mass, you add an additional scalar whose vacuum expectation value generates a mass, and then that solves the issue, and then that becomes consistent. So, but then there is a prediction that in the Higgs sector is a little bit more involved than just the standard Higgs. Yeah.
It's curious. Maxwell's theory is only conformally invariant in four dimensions. Maxwell's theory is only invariant in four dimensions. Conformally invariant.
No, it is invariant also in five dimensions if you include a dilaton, and then the dilaton absorbs the scale
transformation. Well, you have to do things for them.
No, it's perfectly fine. It's perfectly fine. It works.
This is not often known. That Maxwell's theory is not conformally invariant in five dimensions. You have to start doing
not by itself, as I said. You couple the dilaton, and the dilaton absorbs the necessary transformation, and then it is invariant. We'll discuss that. So anyway, so there are very interesting phenomenological
applications of this, in particular in cosmology. One feature of that we are discussing with Neil Turok right now and Steinhardt. They got very interested because it relates to the cyclic model of cosmology. It's predicted as a structure coming from 296. The supersymmetry in 4 plus 2 and higher dimensions has been done. All the way to 2-time supergravity, which is local, under SU22/1 supersymmetry. This leads to no-scale models in 3 plus 1 dimensions, which is the key to understanding a very small cosmological constant. So, and beyond that, there are additional concepts for which I have no time right now. Strings and brains and M-theory, in this language, there is partial progress. Again, no time to describe it. Now, there is non-perturbative technical tools emerging for one-time field theory, because once you understand that there are these dualities, you can begin to try to use them as a tool in the usual way that people can use dualities in order to do computations in different new forms. And so we have done this to some extent to show, in the language of field theory, to show some of these things, and it's still in progress. And there is also a recent paper by Steve Weinberg that shows how to compute directly Green's functions in 4 plus 2 dimensions. He did not quite realize that they would be. It's a very interesting contribution from my point of view to 2-time physics for how to compute directly Green's functions in 4 plus 2 dimensions. And then you can use that. He didn't, but we are trying to use that as a starting point in order to compute Green's functions in all of these different spaces by starting from the same computation in 4 plus 2 dimensions and then projecting down to different curved spaces and other interesting spaces. I think it's a great tool for computations in the future. So eventually, the most fundamental approach for this is field theory in phase space. There is old work on that back in 2001. Some of it with Sergio Ray, and then under development. And I think it's a topic from the point of view of time physics. If progress is fully made in a way that it recovers the others, I think it will be very attractive in my point of view. I'll skip something about 12 dimensions, which is new. You know, people don't know about 12 dimensions much, but anyway. Let me close by just giving you an overall picture as a cartoon, basically, about how 2-time physics should be viewed as a completion and a unifying framework for 1-time physics. So that the relation between 2-time physics and 1-time physics can be described by the following analogy. Consider a room, 3-dimensional room, and an object in that room, so let's say this shape. So imagine that this is representing phase space in 4 plus 2 dimensions. Then imagine many shadows of this object that we create on the wall by shining light, say in this direction, so you will see a circle. Shining light in that direction, you will see a rectangle. Shining light in that direction, you will see a triangle, and so on. So by shining light from different directions on the walls, you will see different shapes. Now, if you are an observer and you are restricted to live on the wall, which is like we are restricted to live in 3 plus 1 dimensions, you see these objects and try to make theories for each one of them, which is what we do, in my view, what we do in one-time physics. And do not get to notice that there are possibly relationships, hidden relationships, between those different theories in one-time physics. But if you are very diligent and you try very hard and so on, you may begin to discover what they are. And we know some of them, like SO4, 2, conformal symmetry in massless particle, which is of great interest for many applications in particle physics. Other hidden symmetries, such as the ones in hydrogen atom, you can discover some of them accidentally or for whatever reason, you know, somebody tells you. But not, you it would be very difficult, but in principle you could discover that there are relations among them, since they are all coming, from the same system in the higher dimensions. So observers like us are stuck on the walls, and we have no privilege to be in the room in 4+2 dimensions. Now, in two-time physics, it turns out that each one of these shadows are actually holographic modulo maybe some issues of topology. The holographic in the sense that all the gauge invariant information of the higher dimensional system is captured by the lower, by the 3+1 dimensional system, because all we are doing is making gauge choices. The gauge invariants are the same. You can recover the gauge invariants in each one of the shadows. So in that sense, it is holographic, jumping dimensions by two. So because they are holographic, there are many relations among the shadows, all of these dualities and hidden symmetries. So these are systematically missed in one-time physics. So this information, the relationship between them, when you finally recover them and understand them, it is information that is related to the higher space-time. The only explanation for those relations is the presence of the higher dimensional space and time, the extra space and the extra time. So instead of interpreting the shadow as being different dynamical systems in one time, you can begin to recognize that they are actually perspectives in a higher space time. So then we can indirectly see, quote unquote, the extra 1+1 dimensions by understanding these relations, these hidden relations, these dualities. So in that sense, there is a way of seeing the extra space and the extra time through these relations. So if you find many of them, you know, you cannot call them all accidental, right? So if there are many of them and there is systematics behind it, that they are all related to what I'm saying, then the only reasonable interpretation is the presence of the extra space and the extra time. And then you get to recognize different parts of that extra space and time within different shadows. So in this sense, I claim one-time physics is incomplete, and you are able to make testable predictions in the language of two-time physics. So do you need two times? And of course, the answer is yes. An analogy in the old times, philosophers talking to one another. Of course, the elements are earth, water, fire, and air, but what about chromium? Just discovered an atom, so it's not any one of those, so you need to change your point of view. So through the examples I have given and the general principle that I have outlined, it's amply evident that one-time physics is incomplete. You just need to study it, okay? So just study it and you will realize it is incomplete. So two-time physics is a new direction in a higher dimensional unification, and so you should expect, and I expect, a lot more predictions at every scale of distance as well as of energy, and more powerful computational tools in future research. So I will end with a quotation from Gell-Mann. Anything which is not forbidden is compulsory. He said that in the context of strong interactions, so whatever can happen in strong interactions, if it's not forbidden by something elementary, it is compulsory, then it must happen. You should go in and look in experiments. And I think in the context of fundamental physics, I'm adopting this point of view. So where you can find more information, I wrote a large number of papers by now. And I have a recent talk about a year ago, less than a year ago, where most of what I have said today is summarized in that talk. In fact, it is 80th celebration for Gell-Mann. And then I have written also a book together with John Turning about extra dimensions, and my part in it is about two times. So it's at the more elementary level. You can download this for free, if you like, from Springer. That's the end.
You hinted that some of the quantum physics was the same, but perhaps not all of it is the same. These are examples that you gave.
The quantum physics is the same. I mean, by the same, I mean you are in the same unitary representation of the solid camera. So now, but the basis, other than Casimir's, right? So the unitary representation is there by Casimir's and then some other operators that commute with one another. So the basis is chosen differently in the physical interpretation, in the one-time physical interpretation. So namely, you are going to diagonalize the Hamiltonian of the given system together, or a function of the Hamiltonian, together with the Casimir's. So, so what you call Hamiltonian is not the same as a function of the generators, is not the same going from one case to the other. For example, massless relativistic particle so I had these elements, right? So among them there was L mu nu, L plus mu, L minus mu, and then L plus minus. So in the case of massless relativistic particle, you say, okay, I have Casimir's, and then I'm going to diagonalize this operator. This operator, in the case of the massless particle, this one was P. And it had the constraint that L plus mu squared is zero, and that is the P squared equal to zero constraint. In this representation, it's zero, not in every representation. So if you diagonalize this particular operator with these Casimir's, then you are describing the massless relativistic particle. Now, say if you want to do hydrogen atom, you would have the same bounds, but you are going to diagonalize something else. So, in the case of the hydrogen atom, the additional quantum numbers are that you take the SO4 plus SO2, SO3 plus SO1 comma to subgroup of the hydrogen atom, where this SO3 is only the derivations. So therefore we have out of these guys L I J angular momentum quantum numbers. So L M if you are in three dimensions. So this is part of what you choose. Then this in this SO1 comma 2 there is an SO2 which corresponds to L 0 prime 0, the rotation of the two times among each other. So this commutes with that. So for this, I can diagonalize, I can put a Casimir associated with that, and then one additional operator. So the additional operator, you choose this L 0 prime 0, and then a Casimir for that, let me call it, is related to JJ plus 1. So it turns out you find, because of the constraints on these guys, you find that this J is related to this L, they are dependent on one another. And then this is the third component, the compact generator of SO1 comma 2, so therefore it must be an integer. So you find that this integer is related to the Hamiltonian, so the Hamiltonian turns out to be minus 1 over L 0 times 0 squared with some coefficient control. So if you choose this basis, the basis, instead of choosing that basis, you choose this basis that are a set of commuting operators. Here you have four of them. Here also you have four. Right? So you find that this is the spectrum of the hydrogen atom, the quantum states, which are in this representation of SO4, comma 2, they are all the states of the hydrogen with the quantum numbers of angular momentum and so on.
Now, if I take this system and are you saying that this is unitarily equivalent to a relativistic particle or a free massive particle?
Yes, and what is the unitary transformation that takes you from this state to that state is the dot product of that state with that state. That's the transformation. Instead of this, I can go to position space, of course, this is the potential space. So how do you go? This is complete. We are in one representation. Right? So this is the complete set of states. All the states of the hydrogen are. This is complete. So is this. So we expand one in terms of the other. And what is the transformation, the unitary transformation from one to the other, is the back product when we diagonalize this guy versus when we diagonalize the other ones. So this is the unitary matrix that transforms you from one state to the other. That is from there. So the same concept applies to all the other cases. It can be done very explicitly, which I have explicit papers, you can look at them. I have done it for a number of these cases, but not for all of them. You know, the ones that I call hard versus easy. Okay, so even some of the hard ones I did, so like the hydrogen and harmonic oscillator among the hard ones. But I haven't done it all. But in principle, one should be able to, doing that means what? It means to find that you can set the classical level fine. But then at the quantum level, because some of the expressions for these guys become nonlinear in the remaining dynamical variables, they become nonlinear. We have to worry about the ordering, the quantum ordering of the factors. So you need to find the correct ordering of the factors so that the closure is right. Okay, so this is, in some of the cases when I say I have not fully done it, this is what I mean, that I have not fully attempted to find the ordering of the operators. But for a number of them, I did. So once you find that, then the closure is right at the quantum level, then you can compute the Casimir, and you will always find the same value, 1 minus d squared over 4. So for the cases that I did, it is, for the massless particle, it is that. For the hydrogen atom, it is that. For the harmonic oscillator, it is. For particle in ds4, it is. ds3 plus s1, it is, and so on and so forth. So you can verify the kind of statements I'm making. They're quite explicit.
It's getting late. This is a field theory question. So I know you haven't done the field theory. Yeah, all of them. So if I picture, I have an SL322 Kalski space time, so I have two extra dimensions. So I write on a QED, and my AU has two.
Are you writing a field theory with two primes? Is that what you're giving me an example of?
Yes.
Okay. My field theory with two primes will not look like your field theory with two primes. There are rules that I have to obey. The rules that I have to obey are that I have to be consistent with the constraints that are underlying at the particle level. So that changes the rules of writing down field theories.
No, I appreciate that.
So once you do that, yeah, then it will not look right.
You need equation range to get rid of these two ghost scaling levels.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so my question is, what do you expect? I mean, we have some very fundamental problems in field theory for 80 years, infinities and, you know, Weisenbohm and stuff. What will change? What will you gain? What do you expect to gain?
For that question, I have not investigated that particular question, didn't go that far yet. But I don't expect it to be different since the shadow. One shadow comes down to what we know, quantum physics, ordinary field theory with quantum physics. So whatever normality normalizability problems they may exist, probably they will also exist.
Mm-hmm.
Probably they will also exist, the normalizability problems probably will also exist, and then you need to find the appropriate renormalizable models. But the guide for that is what we already know in one shadow. So once you resolve it through the help of one shadow, then you have it directly in the extra dimension. And then you can come down to the other shadows and make predictions for what they should look like, the other shadows. So you will gain that. I mean, really what you gain from this game is the usual shadow that you like and you are familiar with is there, maybe with a little bit of modification in the scalar sector of field theory. the other set has higher spins and so on. They are the same. They are not without modification. The scalar sector needs some modification. So the usual shadow is there. So for the usual shadow, you don't learn much except for these additional small constraints. What you do gain is the dualities. So namely that there are dual versions to the things that we already know, and there are predictions for what they are. So this is what you gain.
Perhaps just even though there are plenty of times is going on, so maybe we could thank Itzhak again for our talk.